the next up we have Lathan. Tell us about his work with Neil about the on the CPT universe.
Yes, thank you, Mina. Yes, so the main thing I'll
turn on the bell.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So the main thing I want to tell you about is a couple of recent papers that that I wrote with Neil and our former master's student Kieran Finn about a cosmological scenario where the cosmological background is CPT symmetric. And then I also want to tell you, right a week after our paper, these papers came out, another group rushed out a paper claiming to have experimental evidence for the dark matter candidate that we predicted. So I'll tell you about that. I still don't know what to make of that, but anyway, I'll tell you what the status of that is. But first, I just wanted to briefly mention, I couldn't resist, because we're supposed to be sharing our research interests in case any of them connect with one another. I just want to take a few minutes, because it's appearing on the archive, and I'm excited about it. Another paper that's appearing tonight, I just want to explain the gist of this. So it's called Conformal Quasicrystals and Holography. This one is with Felix Flicker, who is a postdoc at Oxford and used to be a grad student here, and Ben Dickens, who's a very very brilliant grad student at Berkeley, just beginning. So the idea, so I've been interested for the past few years in tilings, quasi-periodic self-similar tilings like the Penrose tiling. I'll show a picture in a minute. A lot of you may have seen the Penrose tiling in one place or another. And these already have one famous application in physics that's garnered a Nobel Prize, which is that they are the canonical mathematical model for the quasicrystals that were these so-called quasicrystals that have been observed, constructed and observed in the lab since the mid-1980s. And I've been interested in the idea that they should connect to physics in a different way, in a second way, which is that they should be the natural discretization space for theories with scale invariance. So if you have a theory where the primary, most important symmetry is its translational invariance, then there's the natural space on which to discretize that theory is an ordinary lattice. And I want to say an analogy that if you have a theory that where the most important symmetry is scale invariance, that the so like a condensed matter system, for example, near its critical point, if you want to take the field theory describing that and discretize it in a way that exactly preserves some discrete subgroup of the conformal symmetry in the same way that a lattice preserves some exact discrete subgroup of translational symmetry, that the natural lattice is a tiling like the Penrose tiling. And so this is about that. Okay, so what is the idea in brief? So this is a famous M.C. Escher image of angels and demons, and it's supposed to be a picture of hyperbolic space. So, the sphere is the two-dimensional surface with constant positive curvature. Hyperbolic space is the harder to visualize surface with constant negative curvature. But here, the most common visualization of it is like this. You do a conformal mapping that preserves angles but squashes lengths. And you map the whole thing to a disk here. So really, all of these demons you're supposed to imagine are exactly congruent to one another, the same size and shape, but they've just been distorted under this conformal map. And for the past 20 years in high-energy physics, one of the central topic in high-energy theory has been exploring this duality that has been discovered between theories with gravity that live in the bulk of hyperbolic space. The duality says that they're exactly dual to some corresponding theory without gravity, but with conformal invariance that lives on the boundary of the space. And in recent years, over the past several years, people have been interested in exploring this, a discretized version of this correspondence. So they discretize the hyperbolic space in the bulk in a way that preserves some exact discrete subgroup of its isometry group. So hyperbolic space, like the sphere, is this very symmetrical space. And this is a tiling that, this is a tiling by regular septagons that fit three around each vertex. And so it doesn't have the full symmetry of hyperbolic space, but it has this enormous infinite subgroup of it. And they're interested in this both for modeling discrete, applying the sort of ADS-CFT-like correspondence to describe actual discrete condensed matter systems living on the boundary, or because they want to, there's been this idea of it from qubit that in some sense space may emerge from quantum entanglement in this framework, and people have been trying to understand that by discretizing the whole thing and thinking of tensors and qubits living on the vertices so that the whole problem can be rephrased in the language of quantum information and quantum error correction. And you might say the main observation that we make in this paper is that if you do this, if you discretize hyperbolic space in a way like this that preserves, that respects its symmetry group, and now you look out towards the boundary and you ask, well, what discretized space am I inducing on the boundary, that it's actually not a lattice. It's a self-similar quasi-crystal, like the Penrose tiling, but except with different global topological properties, so that it has it admits a natural action by the correspondingly discretized conformal group that acts on the boundary. When we discretize the symmetry group in the bulk, turns out that correspondingly discretizes the conformal group on the boundary. And there are these very fascinating types of quasicrystals that we call conformal quasicrystals that live on the boundary that provide a discrete model, now in a very concrete way, of the conformal geometry of the boundary and that are acted on by the conformal group. And so these pictures are supposed to, so the idea is that the intuitive idea here is that, so suppose I take any little starting seed of tiles S in hyperbolic space, and I can label the boundary of S by a string of labels. And so here's one way to do it. If I draw a curve around here, if I look at each tile, I label it by the number of vertices it has inside the curve. So here, this one has two vertices inside, this one has two vertices inside, two. This one has three vertices inside. There's a four. So this is some periodic string, 2, 2, 2, 3, 2, 2, 2. OK, there's another labeling scheme. And then, now if I take that seed of tiles and I surround it by the next layer, I add a ring of new tiles around it, then my old labeling gets replaced by a new, larger string. And the idea is that this new larger string is related to the earlier string by a substitution rule. Oops, there's a typo here. So every 2 that used to be in this string gets replaced by the string 2, 2, 3 in the next bigger string. And every time there's a 3 over here, that should say 3, it gets replaced by the string 2, 3 in the next bigger string. And that turns out to be the sort of substitution rule that produces that produces a quasicrystal at the boundary. In other words, it produces a sequence that is at the boundary. You get a sequence of 2s and 3s that is an infinite string of 2s and 3s that has, it's quasi-periodic in the sense that it has no finite period. There's no finite distance you can go and then see and then find that the sequence repeats. So that's the sense in which it's quasi-periodic, and it's self-similar in that when you take the sequence at the boundary and apply this transformation to it, it just gets mapped to itself. And then this turns out to work in higher, there turns out to be interesting analogs of this in higher dimensions. Here is a picture that I found on the internet of, in three-dimensional hyperbolic space, there's this beautiful, here we have a regular tiling of two-dimensional hyperbolic space. In three-dimensional hyperbolic space, similarly, you can it's all in a ball. You can tile it by icosahedra. There's this self-dual tiling by icosahedra. And it turns out that when you follow this thing to the boundary, you get the honest-to-God Penrose tiling living at the boundary, or something very, very close to it. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say. That there's other interesting things to say about how to actually represent conformal field theories or the quantum states of conformal field theories on these tilings. But if you're interested in that, I recommend looking at the paper or talking to me afterwards. And I'm going to go on. That was probably a bit of a blitz, but I'm going to go on to the next the actual topic of the talk. Unless anyone has any questions. Yes.
Are quasi crystals in 3D, 4D known to exist, or is it a two-dimensional, one-dimensional thing?
They do exist. They exist in 3D and 4D, also. It turns out that once you go past 4D, there's a sense in which they only go up to 4D, in the sense that once you go beyond that, their symmetry groups are no longer irreducible. So you can kind of think of higher dimensional ones as being products of two lower dimensional quasicrystals. So there's something interesting that happens when you get up to four dimensions, but then there's another sense in which they keep going to arbitrarily high dimensions. Okay. So the main topic that I wanted to talk about is this paper with Neil and Karen. And so what is the idea? In cartoon, it's the following. So here's a cartoon picture of the expanding universe. So we live up here. And observationally, when we look back, we can look back observationally, roughly speaking, depending on exactly how you define it, to a few seconds after the Big Bang. And at that time, what we see is that the universe was radiation dominated and expanding and in a very simple state, almost perfectly homogeneous and isotropic, with a small power law spectrum of Gaussian density perturbations. And so, the standard view is that in order to explain that initial simple state, that we should imagine that there is an earlier unobserved epoch of inflation, in which the universe, it's argued that if the universe underwent a burst of accelerated expansion, that's claimed to produce the simple conditions on the initial state. So the simple conditions on this state present a puzzle, and one, there are clearly some hint about what happened, how the universe began. And the question is, what is the interpretation of that hint? Here is one interpretation. So here we want to explore a different possible interpretation, which is that another way to say how these conditions are special is that they allow you to, near the bang, the metric is just really the full spacetime metric is just the Minkowski metric times an overall conformal factor, a squared of t. And that conformal factor is really as simple as it can be during the radiation era. It's just proportional to the conformal time. The only thing that's funny about it is that it passes through zero. So what we usually call the Big Bang singularity is, well, it's a very special, very, Another way to say what's special about these conditions is that the Big Bang is that the singularity that's in our past appears to be of this very special type. That's a pure conformal vial singularity, meaning that the only thing that's singular about it is that the conformal factor is passing through zero for a moment, but in a way that is completely analytic, so that there's a maximal analytic extension of this space-time to a two-sided cone. And so let's take the hint to mean that maybe we should think about this space-time and see where that leads us. And so the first thing you notice when you do this is that in addition to the normal symmetries of FRW, normally the symmetries of an FRW spacetime are it has spatial rotational symmetry, and it has spatial translations, and it has spatial parity. But now when we continue it, the extended spacetime also has a new isometry. It has time reversal symmetry under reflection about the midline there. And so the interesting thing about that is that so there's this phenomenon that occurs in quantum field theory on curved spacetime, which is that unlike in flat spacetime field, in flat spacetime quantum field theory, there's an unambiguous vacuum that all inertial observers agree on, which is there's a unique vacuum in Minkowski space that respects all of the symmetries of Minkowski space. But in a general curved spacetime, and in particular in FRW spacetime, the choice of vacuum is ambiguous, and different observers at different times, who live at different times or have different states of motion in the spacetime, will disagree about what the notion of zero particles means. And the interesting thing about this new isometry is that it picks out a preferred vacuum, the vacuum that respects the full CPT, the full symmetry of this FRW background. And so this has a bunch of interesting aspects to it, but the thing I want to tell you about here is about how this leads to a new picture for what the dark matter could be, and some new predictions about that. So that's what I want to explain here. So in order to explain that, let's have a lightning review of what's in the standard model. So here's my little table that I'm about to fill in with standard model particles. So first of all, there are the gauge bosons. There's SU3, SU2, and U1 gauge bosons. And then there are the fermions. What fermions are there in the standard model? There's the left-handed quark doublet, in other words, the up left and the down left. There's the corresponding upright and downright. Those are the quarks. And then there are the analogous leptons. There's the left-handed lepton doublet, the left-handed neutrino and left-handed electron, and then the corresponding right-handed neutrino and right-handed electron. And they transform in certain ways. The standard model is specified by telling you how these different fermions transform under the gauge group. So all the quarks transform as triplets under SU3. The leptons transform trivially as singlets. All the left-handed guys transform as doublets under SU2. The right-handed guys transform trivially. And then they have some hypercharges. Oh, and then let's not forget one more particle, the Higgs doublet, which also has some charges. It's a singlet under SU3. It doesn't couple to SU3, but it's a doublet under SU2. It does couple to the weak force, and it has some hypercharge. Now, the point that I want to make about this table is that there's only one possible dark matter candidate in this table. But in other words, there's only one particle here that can be stable for longer than the Hubble time. But we haven't directly detected it yet. And that is, so one of these three species, I forgot to mention. So the one other thing, this index I up here is the family index. It runs from 1 to 3. There's all the fermions in the standard model come in three copies, three flavors. And so there's three flavors of right-handed neutrino here. And it's still possible that one of these guys can be exactly stable. You can't make more than one of them, stable without contradicting what we know about low-energy neutrino physics, but it's still perfectly possible that one of them is exactly stable. And so normally, so that would be the only dark matter candidate in this table. Normally, that doesn't seem like a good dark matter candidate. Normally, that's not considered as a dark matter candidate because in the same limit that it becomes exactly stable, it turns out that it becomes completely decoupled from all the other particles in the standard model. It only talks to gravity. All of its coupling constants with all the remaining particles are set to zero. And so it doesn't get produced at all by the thermal bath in the early universe. So it's all well and good for it to be stable, but if you can't make any of it in the universe, then it's not a good dark matter candidate. And so what I want to say is that when you take, if now we take this perspective that the universe is actually in the preferred CPT invariant state, then because that state differs from the late time vacuum, the notion of zero particles that we would define in this room today, that there is a predicted abundance of these guys, even if they were perfectly stable. So that's what I want to explain next. So here I've just written, I should have, I'm really talking about new sub-right here, that dark matter candidate I was just, but I should have, anyway, this is, so psi is a spinner. So normally when you quantize a spinner, when you canonically quantize it, you decompose it into a basis of positive and negative frequency solutions of the Dirac equation, and the coefficients in front of the positive frequency solutions are the annihilation operators for the particle, and the coefficients in front of the negative frequency solutions are the creation operators for the corresponding antiparticle. And again, the problem in curved spacetime in general is that different observers can't agree about which solutions of the Dirac equation are positive frequency and which solutions are negative frequency. There's an intrinsic ambiguity. So if we go back to our picture here, observers at late time, like us, we will regard if we split the solutions to the Dirac equation into the positive frequency and negative frequency parts, we will call certain solutions positive frequency. I'll call those psi plus, for the pluses for meaning the late time observers positive frequency solutions. And so when we do this expansion, that'll define a certain set of creation and annihilation operators, and those define a certain state in the Hilbert space. The state that is annihilated by all of these is what we today in this room would call the vacuum, the zero particle state. Similarly, an observer at early times, long before the bang, would have a different set of different decomposition of the solutions. They would call a different set of modes positive frequency. I'll call those psi minus. And so they would define a different vacuum state, zero minus. So according to us, their vacuum has a non-zero abundance of particles, and according to them, our vacuum has a non-zero abundance of particles. But neither of those vacua are CPT invariant. Neither of those decompositions are CPT invariant. It turns out there is a decomposition that is CPT invariant. Okay, and it defines this preferred vacuum I was talking about. And the key point is that the CPT invariant positive frequency mode functions are related to our late time mode functions in this room, positive and negative frequency, by a so-called Bogle-Yuboff transformation. So there's the two Bogle-Yuboff coefficients, alpha and beta. And by solving the Dirac equation on this background, you can explicitly calculate what alpha and beta are. In other words, how our late time modes are related to the CPT invariant modes. And then the famous fact about Bogle-Yuboff transformations is that the expectation, if the universe is really in this vacuum, this quantum state, then according to us, using our number operator, the number operator that we would define in this room for particles, the expected number of particles of these dark matter particles in particular is given by the square of the Bogoliubov beta coefficient, which in this case turns out to be some expression that's, so this is P, the momentum of the part, the co-moving momentum of the particle, and then the reduced Planck mass divided by the mass of the particle. And then this is rho 1 is the energy density of the radiation at the same scale factor at which the co-moving momenta is defined. So these are both co-moving quantities. So you... Okay. And so that's somehow the basic idea, that there is this non-zero abundance of these particles just due to the hypothesis that the universe is in the CPT state and we at late times have a different notion of number operator. So if we come back to the standard model, the idea is that we're going to take the one available particle available to us in that table before, assume that it's stable. So that its stability is equivalent to saying that the Lagrangian has some symmetry, Z2 symmetry under that, that field goes to minus itself. Using the formula at the bottom of the previous slide, you can then calculate what is the ratio. This is a dimensionless ratio. The ratio at early times of the number of dark matter particles, the density of dark matter particles, to the entropy density of the radiation. And then that ratio is conserved from that point until, from early times until today. And it's just given by the mass of the dark matter particle over the Planck mass times some dimensionless combination. This is some twos and pies and number you can calculate basically exactly. And so that means that in order to predict the right we measure the abundance of dark matter today, the energy density of dark matter in the universe today. And in order for this prediction to match the measured value, m dark matter has to have a certain value. And so that value turns out to be 4.8 times 10 to the 8 GeV, or in other words, 480 PeV. So that is our predicted dark matter mass. We predict that the dark matter is this right-handed neutrino and that it's this heavy. And then if this scenario is right, there are a couple of other associated predictions. So again, in this model, there's three heavy neutrinos and there's three light neutrinos. These are the three that we have directly observed. And so the first prediction is that these three light neutrinos are all Majorana particles. And so in particular, they can mediate neutrinoless double beta decay. So this is something that there are these ongoing searches for neutrinoless double beta decay. You can't predict exactly. Unfortunately, we don't know enough of the parameters in the neutrino sector to predict the actual rate of neutrinoless double beta decay. Although there's a rough predicted rate that predates our work based on if this seesaw picture with three heavy neutrinos and three light neutrinos is right. And so it's in the ballpark of what one should be hoping to there are good reasons to hope that ongoing neutrinoless double beta decay experiments will see something, but unfortunately you can't be sure. But anyway, if we predict they should. The next thing is that of the three light neutrinos, currently we've only measured the differences in mass between the three light neutrinos, not their overall mass. But if one of the three heavy neutrinos is really this stable dark matter candidate, it means that one of the corresponding light neutrinos is exactly massless. Okay, and so that will be measured with, that'll be tested with forthcoming cosmological experiments. Cosmological experiments measure the sum of these three neutrinos, and they're currently pushing down on it. And the current upper bound is 0.0, is roughly 0.2 eV. But you can't push down more than, you know, given that we know the spacings, these measured differences, you can only push so far down. The lowest you can go is to have the lowest guy be zero. And depending on whether the hierarchy is the normal hierarchy like this, or the inverted hierarchy like that, this is, a figure would have been nice here, but this is the figure by finger here. Yeah. depending on whether it's the normal or inverted hierarchy, that means that we predict that that cosmological experiments should eventually find that this sum of the three neutrino masses is either 0.05 eV or 0.1 eV, respectively. And then finally, so far I've talked about the two, those are the three light neutrinos, and then one of these heavy neutrinos is the dark matter. The other two guys cannot be stable. They decay at very early times. They're produced at early times by the same mechanism that I just discussed, but then they relax to their thermal abundance, and so it turns out that when they decay, they just undergo ordinary thermal leptogenesis. So the good news is that they can, the decay of those other two neutrinos can explain very neatly the observed asymmetry between matter and antimatter. The bad news is that we don't have any new predictions about that. So then here is the next thing I was going to mention. So I don't quite know what to make of this. There was this paper that came out a week after ours that makes the following observation. So apparently something that we did not know is that a few years ago, cosmic neutrino experiments, high energy neutrino detectors, the one you probably are most likely to have heard of is the IceCube experiment. IceCube is this ongoing experiment. It was the first one to measure the spectrum of astrophysical high energy neutrinos, and it's this falling power law spectrum, so that they see fewer and fewer high energy neutrinos as they go to higher and higher energy, and eventually, they have not seen any neutrinos above 2 PeV. They've seen a couple at 2 PeV. This other experiment, ANITA, is a balloon that flies. It's a high altitude balloon with a bunch of radio horns attached to it, and it flies above the Antarctic ice and looks down at it and looks for radio signals generated by upgoing high-energy neutrino events in the ice. And it has detected two strange upgoing events that, with roughly the same energy, a couple hundred PeV. So in other words, two strange events which are 100 times larger than where the ice cube spectrum peters out. There's this gap. They're both roughly the same energy, and they're both relatively steeply upgoing, suggesting that they are coming, suggesting that they may be coming from inside the Earth rather than from astrophysical sources. So it is an intriguing thing. They just point out that it's intriguing that these two events are anomalously offset from the rest above these two highest energy events are anomalously offset above the rest of the astrophysical neutrino background and appear to be coming up out of the Earth and are at roughly the same energy as we predict. So that's the good news. The bad news is that we are worried that we cannot get enough of our dark matter particles to be bound to the Earth to produce the number of events that they're seeing. So we're still thinking about that, but I'm a little worried that that's not going to work out. So I would love to say that this is like a killer confirmation, but I don't think it's quite like that. But anyway, it's definitely intriguing, and we're still thinking about. I went considerably faster than I thought I was going to go. That's great. I thought I wasn't going to have really time to talk about the rest of this stuff, and maybe it's for the best if I don't. But I'm always so thrilled when someone finishes early. I'm trying to resist the temptation to just expand into the allotted time. There are a bunch of other interesting things that are related to this scenario. I thought I was just going to focus on the dark matter stuff. Let me see. Something important to mention is that there has been a lot of previous work about cosmological scenarios that do not invoke inflation in the early universe and instead invoke a period before the Big Bang. And a lot of it has been done by people in the building here. So those are important precedents for this work. There's more on the way. If you have any questions about anything you see on the screen, feel free to ask. But maybe I'll just stop there. Thank you very much.
Understand what is motivating you to restrict your attention to a single set of three right-handed neutrino flavors? Or in other words, why can't I consider other additional particles I actually could reproduce through the same mechanism?
Yeah, indeed, you could. You could. You know, I like the idea that there's I think it is more likely than not that those three right-handed neutrinos are there, even on the grounds that, you know, they give the simplest renormalizable explanation for the neutrino oscillations, and they respect the pattern of three families, and they respect the pattern. They sort of finish off the pattern of particles in the standard model so that every left-handed particle has a right-handed partner that has the same U1 times SU3 charge, and that the leptons become just a color-free analog of the quarks, and they all fit beautifully into a spinner of SO10, and and they can do leptogenesis. So I like the idea that it's not fair to say it's quite the minimal thing, because you could still get away with just the left-handed neutrinos and just saying that neutrino masses are due to non-renormalizable term, but in a sense that just postpones the problem to higher energies. I mean, it's the minimal thing that really explains the neutrino masses in a renormalizable framework, and then also does these two other cosmological things and has these other theoretical niceties. So I think it's more likely than not that they're there, I'm just very interested in seeing if one can explain everything without invoking anything more. You're certainly right that it is possible that there are additional particles out there, and indeed they are subject to the same. If they're weakly coupled enough, they're subject to the same mechanism. And that's something I didn't mention, but you know, in the standard model, you really can't apply the calculation that we did to anything but the right-handed neutrinos and the graviton, because it needs to be sufficiently weakly coupled that the dominant effect on it is this QFT and curved spacetime effect, whereas all the other particles in the standard model are bumping into one another on timescales near the Big Bang, on timescales shorter than the characteristic important time here, which is, it turns out that the important time for this Bogle-Yubov transformation, the characteristic, the time at which everything happens, is roughly one Compton period after the Big Bang. One is a Compton wavelength over C after the Big Bang for the particle that you're interested in. So, yeah, it turns out that not necessarily any other field you add to the standard model can apply this line of thinking to. But if it's dark enough, then you can. You know, if it's decoupled enough, then.
Maybe you're somewhat understating the case.
Which is what?
Which is that this is the simplest model of dark matter. Full stop.
Yeah, what he said.
but surprisingly, it's been overlooked. So I would say, if this is right, it means the dark matter has been hiding in plain sight for 40 years, ever since we suspected neutrinos had masses.
I'm going to take a risk and be totally at the beginning of your talk. We're coming in with the linear expansion. You're going through zero, and you were talking about the apparent vacuum for us from our number operator annihilation state. If it's linear, is there no symmetry that said someone at the same time on the opposite would have to see the same vacuum state as us? Isn't that a requirement? And if it is, how come those two equations didn't just go back to zero?
Yes. So let's see. So I didn't really explain very well here, but so I'm thinking in terms of the Heisenberg picture of quantum mechanics, where the state is just time independent and the operators evolve with time. So really what's happening here is these are the creation and annihilation operators at early time. And as I evolve them in the Heisenberg picture, at later times they evolve into A0, and then at later times they evolve into A+. And so the idea is that in this picture, if the universe is in this state, it's in this state for all time. So it's in this state, and we, the late time observer, see some consequences, and then the early time observer sees the exact CPT reverse of those consequences. So actually we see, you know, it turns out we see a universe according to this picture with a slight excess of matter over antimatter and density perturbations in certain places, and they see some sort of flipped version of that and a slight excess of antimatter over matter. And in fact, we really think that we think that the two sides are actually not independent. We think they're actually, honest to God, redundant. We're talking about a redundant unfolded picture of the space time. But that's something we're writing a paper about.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
So, trying to wrap up my mind around this. Yeah. So where does it start exactly?
Someone later told me that it was already a Star Trek episode from like 30 years ago. I don't feel bad about people wrapping their mind around it. I feel like there's a huge community out there that knew it before us. But
so next talk, you can just show us the episode.
Yeah, you know, I've been meaning to watch the episode. I haven't even seen it.
So there is no inflation period. So that's why you don't have any. Primordial gravitational waves, I guess.
Kind of, yeah. Yes, it's true that inflation in general, how much primordial gravitational waves they predict depends on this unknown scale of inflation, but indeed, they predict some level of primordial gravitational waves. Here, it turns out because the graviton is decoupled and massless, all of these. The Bogle-Yubov coefficient between all of these different states is zero. So they're all, you know, the background is conformal to Minkowski is an overall scale factor in front times the Minkowski metric. So that means that if you're a conformally invariant field, which a massless free field is, you don't feel the difference between Minkowski space and the FRW background. It's really that's why there was this factor of the mass appearing in the Bogle-Yubov transformation between the different states. So the more massive you are, the more distinct these states are for you, and so the more particles are produced. So for gravitons, it ends up being zero, or at least in the approximation that the graviton is free, it's zero. At sufficiently small wavelengths for modes that enter very close to the Planck, for modes that left the horizon very close to the Planck time, that probably goes wrong, but it's probably not true. But for very long wavelengths, there's essentially, like you say, because there's no inflation, there's essentially no gravitation.
I guess you can still explain all the things that inflation can explain at the horizon.
Well, we don't yet in our first papers. There's some Venn diagram of what we explain and what inflation explains, and there's some overlap, and then there are some things that each side explains that the other one does not. Indeed, we hope one. So the key things that we don't claim to explain in the first paper, but that we think we can explain and are working on at the moment, are: why is the universe homogeneous and isotropic? We take that as a assumption in our first calculation. And then also, we can explain the, you know, when inflation generates the primordial spectrum of density perturbations, and then it's very nicely confirmed, that prediction by the CMB. And there's really two aspects of that prediction. One is the phases of the primordial scalar perturbations, And then there's the amplitude, there's the spectrum. There's the amplitude as a function of k of the primordial perturbations. And so what we point out in the first paper is we can explain the phases, why you see the peaks and valleys of the CMB at certain angular L, certain spherical harmonic L values. But the spectrum is something that we think we know how to explain, but we're still working on it. And so it'll be either very good or very bad if that doesn't work out. So indeed, there are the key thing is that there are crucial points that we have not yet claimed to be able to explain in this way.
Okay, thanks, Layton again.